सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
सोच विचार टुडे वी आर गोइंग टू टेक अप द होल इशू ऑफ डेवलपमेंट डिस्कोर्स इन पाकिस्तान एंड डेवलपमेंट इशूज इन पाकिस्तान। आई हैव गॉट विद मी अ यंग मैन Imran Khan, who writes about these issues, who has been working on these issues for a while. So let's take up the issue of development in general. Welcome, Imran.
Thank you, Dr. Nadeem Ul Haq. It's really an honor to be on this podcast. And
thank you.
Yeah, Imran, I'm very excited to be talking to you about these issues.
Thank you. Imran Saab, tell me first, before we begin, give people some idea about yourself. It's always good to give people a framework as to who they're listening to and what is he talking about. So some idea of your education, what you're doing, et cetera, et cetera. Very briefly.
Right. So I originally hail from the Azad Jammu and Kashmir. I was born and raised in Muzaffarabad. Mm-hmm. But then I came to Lahore for my college education. I studied at Government College Lahore. Mm-hmm. Then I studied at Qaid-e Azam University. I got involved in the social development sector in Pakistan. I worked for almost 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then for the last couple of years, I've been on an academic sabbatical. I got a Chevening scholarship in 2016. And I went to London School of Economics to study anthropology and development. Mm-hmm. The reason why I took a sabbatical from my development practitioner career was that, you know, I'd started thinking critically about how the development is conceived and implemented in Pakistan. I've had, reservations about how we do the work that we do.
Great.
So I thought, you know, sort of an academic critical lens would be interesting.
Let me ask you, first of all, you are an old Dravian like myself. You're an old, you're an LSE graduate like myself. So it's wonderful to meet you and, learn from you. But tell me briefly, what are you doing now in the U.S.? You're in the U.S. right now, right?
Right. So I am currently based at the Penn State University.
Okay.
In central Pennsylvania. The reason why I'm here is because my wife is a PhD student here.
Okay.
But I use that opportunity to do my own research because I have access to libraries and there's a great infrastructure here.
Wonderful, wonderful. So now tell me, you've been working in the social development sector in Pakistan. Mashallah, you've got international experience. You've been a Chevening Fellow. What is your concern about the development discourse in Pakistan? The new government is in. I'm sure they'd love to hear from people like you, young blood, as to what do you think needs to be done? How do you think they should address the current issues? So, the floor is yours. Tell me.
Yeah, so I think, you know, depending upon one's perspective, one could approach this issue from different angles. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what my angle is.
Mm-hmm.
I think the major problem with the development discourse and the project implementation in Pakistan is that our version of development is apolitical and ahistorical. When we think about these development issues, and by we, I mean the development practitioners, people, you know, consultants, economists. When we think about these issues, we do not take into account the political economy of our society, the power relations, the social structures. And therefore, the development projects, they not only fail, but they have some unintended effects. We can talk shortly, we can talk about those unintended effects as well. But what do I mean when I say that, you know, our development discourse is apolitical, it doesn't take into account political realities, and ahistorical. For example, you know, if you are implementing a service delivery project or awareness campaign or anything in the rural areas of Pakistan, whether that's Sindh or Punjab, you have to take into account that, you know, our society is divided into classes. There are some people who are already privileged, others who are not. And the way people engage with state and their access to state is also very different. Mm-hmm. But in our simplistic development models, we assume that, you know, everyone is like, there is sort of this underlying assumption that we'll go in there and with this miracle of our project, everything, those power inequalities will change and everyone will be able to access our development project and resources equally.
So what you're saying is basically that the problem is not going to be solved by projects alone. And this issue of advocacy projects and other livelihood projects and all these fancy acronyms that donors have, they are not addressing the fundamental political economy of the country. Is that
that's
right?
Precisely my point.
But then the point is, the issue lies with that: should we be following the donors or not? Has development ever happened following the donors?
Well, it hasn't. I mean, the evidence tells us that it hasn't happened. Look at the Southeast Asian models, which are widely discussed. They were not, South Korea did not necessarily develop because of these development projects by their donors.
But then think about it in that way, then the problem lies at home. The problem is that we basically, the way I look at it is, we basically want to keep the colonial system alive. We have a system that the British left us. The system was designed in the 19th century. The civil service, the judiciary, everything was designed in the 19th century for two major purposes. One purpose was they wanted to keep the population in check. They didn't want to bring a lot of money here. The second purpose, and they didn't want to bring a lot of people here. The second purpose was to take resources from here and take them back to England. So it was an extractive economy. It was extraction and control that was the purpose of the economy. We've still got an extraction and control mechanism. The only difference is, instead of white people running it, people like you and me run it, right? The donors come in to help that system, but the way I look at it, they're really just simply keeping the system alive. They don't want to change the system. They want to keep it alive. I'm not saying it's a conspiracy, but that's the way it turns out to be, because it is not for the outsiders to change the system. The insiders have to change the system. So what I put to you is, the fault is ours. We don't want to change the system. Donors can't change the system.
Right. Yeah. Your analysis is absolutely spot on. And this is where our predicament lies. Mm-hmm. As you pointed out, that this is a problem that, you know, that has to be fixed at our state and society level, right? But you know, what makes the whole thing complicated is that the development projects by donors and national community and the NGOs, they distract the attention of the society. They create this false hope and narrative that, you know, they are going to fix it. They also sort of channel all the opposition and resistance.
Isn't it a happy circumstance, a marriage of convenience of the donors and the extractive powers that be, the civil service, the judiciary, people like us, the Punjab Club members, the Sindh Club members, the Gymkhana members. Hey, let's keep the party alive and let's do a few projects like NRSP or PRSP or this or that. I mean, there are so many projects just hanging around while the government is going to shreds. The government doesn't have the money or even the resources to define a simple education policy. Yet there are education advocacy funds, education development funds. So Michael Barber will come there, McKinsey's will come there, but we don't have the money to pay our teachers. No.
Yeah, so I mean, go. Right. So Dr. Nadeemul Haq, as you are pointing out, there is a symbiotic relationship between the international donors and NGOs and states such as ours. One of the ethnographic studies that I always refer to when critiquing development is by James Ferguson. He's an American anthropologist. The name of the book is The Anti-Politics Machine: Development, Depoliticization, and Bureaucratic Power in Lesotho.
Oh, great. I must get that, huh? Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ferguson shows that even though invariably these development projects fail, but one of the things that they do is that they extend and expand the power of bureaucracy. So in some cases, people are better off not sort of directly engaging with the state, right? And what happens is that instead of doing the social development that these projects are supposed to do, they increase, they entrench those, re-entrench those inequalities in society, and they extend the sort of, you know, the negative control of the state as well. So yeah, it's a situation, and this is where predicament is. It's a situation that benefits our state elites who control the power, who accumulate all the wealth, who benefit from the inequality in society, and it benefits donors and NGOs. But look, I think, you know, our critique should be much more complex than this. You know, let's not just fall for these meta narratives such as, you know, all development is bad, and, you know, sort of. So I think the sort of the reality lies in studying development more closely, and, you know, sort of going into all the nitty-gritties of it.
The point is, isn't that, now let's get to the development discourse thing. Okay, fair enough. So you've explained the political economy very well, that we've got this old colonial system, and we've got the, that we've inherited, the elite is in power, and the donors come in to try and do this tinkering around with development, socio-economic projects, building BISP, etc. But all that it does is keeps the political economy intact. Right?
Yeah.
The system.
Yeah, great.
But now think about it this way. What about the Pakistani thinkers? Do they play a role? The way I look at it, I don't know whether you've read my book or not. One of the things that I put out in my book is that, and I will defend that by looking at history, that history is made by networks of thinkers who put forward ideas that change things. For example, the Greeks put forward some ideas, along came Christianity in Iraq, they put forward some ideas, then came the Renaissance, and then came the Enlightenment, and then came the Reformation. I mean, all these changes were thinkers floating ideas in the body public. And then those ideas caught on and things developed. In the same case in India, for example, it was Gandhi, Jinnah, Nehru, etc., who put out the idea of Iqbal. These guys put out the idea of independence. That caught on and we got independence. What are our thinkers doing? Are they putting out any fresh ideas?
Well, it's a very difficult question to answer. I think we definitely lack in the kind of scholarship that can help us. There definitely, you know, people are publishing good works such as yours, you know, Dr. Ishrat Hussain's book, Governing the Ungovernable, and, you know, a few other scholarly works that have come out in the last years. But perhaps our, you know, our repertoire of scholarship on the, you know, sort of reforming society as complex as ours is weak, and that this is one of the reasons. But then there is another reason that do you think that if that scholarship is out there, the people who make the policy, who make the decisions, they are going to engage with that? I don't necessarily think so.
No, but I think quite frankly, Imran, the policymakers don't engage with things. For example, take the French king at the time of the French Revolution. He didn't want to engage with them. Take the Charles II, they didn't want to engage with the thinkers, but then their heads were chopped off, and change takes a long time, but at least the change makers, the ideas are there. In Pakistan, what I find amazing is that people are just not discussing what you're saying. The political economy discussion is not taking place, right?
Well, how can it take place when, you know, everyone is just engaged in the sound bites, when, you know, the discourse is so polarized that you just go on Twitter and people are just, is PTI good or bad? And just, you know, people have made it so essentialize this whole discourse, and it's all polemics, and that's why nobody is, like, we are wasting our time all the time on social media engaging with these very banal discussions. So yeah, it's like we have to engage with those debates at deeper level, and that's the responsibility of students and civil society and everyone for that matter.
But that's the problem. What I find is when I go to Pakistan and I want to give a talk at universities and say, okay, I want to talk about my book, or I want to talk about political economy or whatever, or other subjects, like, for example, let's say civil service reform, or this podcast that I do where I'm trying to raise a lot of development issues. What I find is that there's not a large number of thinkers who are interested in these things. And they want to always curry favor with the donors or with the incumbent political government. They do not want to engage in deeper reform ideas that need to be, for example, constitutional amendments. Nobody discusses them. For example, civil service reform. Very little discussion. For example, the reform of the education system. No, they want to spend more money on education, but nobody discusses those things. So I think, isn't it a fault of the thinkers as well that they're not enough? And even when you write, for example, I have these podcasts, I write books, very few people want to talk about them. The student bodies in Pakistan, even the US, they want to invite right. ambassadors and government officials. They don't want to invite thinkers to talk about these things.
I think it's at one level, it is our fault. And by us, I mean people like yourself and people mm-hmm. like myself. You know, we've made these issues mm-hmm. very technocratic. Right. We who work for donors, we who are experts of different disciplines. Right. So people mm-hmm. are, you know, intimidated by mm-hmm. these topics and these discussions. That's one explanation. The other mm-hmm. explanation, Dr. Nadeemul Haq, mm-hmm. is that mm-hmm. because of dictatorships, because of highly authoritarian state, our masses have been depoliticized. Mm-hmm. We do not have strong, robust social movements mm-hmm. because social movements, which are organic, they can engage people with these ideas. They can tell people that, you know, it's not the domain of economists only mm-hmm. to talk about mm-hmm. the politics and economy. These things are, at some level, they are very common sense, right? Mm-hmm. Social justice, mm-hmm. redistribution of resources. These are issues that, you know, everyone can understand. Again, it just comes back to the way our political economy has worked. Yeah, but point. Also, partly, we have to tell people, well, our livelihood will suffer, but we'll have to, you know, sort of.
So tell me, what should we do? How should we move forward? What is your strategy? You're a young man. I can only do this, what I'm doing. What is your strategy moving forward? How do you think you can change things?
I think we need to engage with this development discourse. Mm-hmm. And we have to develop critiques from within, because this, today we are talking about these whole development apparatus. It's big. There are a lot of, mm-hmm. platforms and funds available. And there are some good things that have happened because of this apparatus. So that's one strategy that I have as a development professional. But I think the solution lies in talking more politics, but not in the sense most of us are talking on the social media. Just going beyond these binaries and polemics. It's like more debate, more dialogue. That's the solution.
Okay, tell me, what would you lastly just think about this? What would your advice be to students who might listen to this in terms of their political theses, their term papers or their publications, or for example even in terms of developing conferences and inviting speakers to their universities? Are there things that they can do to improve the dialogue?
Well, they can definitely, and I think they should. One of the things that our students need to appreciate is that even if, you're studying in a government school or a government university where you may not have great teachers, great library, you can still do a lot. Mm-hmm. So I studied at a government school in Muzaffarabad in my town. I went to government universities in Pakistan. I could not afford to go to private school or private university, but I, engaged with the politics, with the scholarship on my country. You can still find those resources if you are curious and if you want to see change in your life, and that is sort of related to change in your society. So, go beyond your curriculum, mm-hmm. ask critical questions, mm-hmm. Question everything, right. Even your own discipline, whether you're economist or anthropologist, yeah. Just question and critically think about the main narratives and the frameworks that you are being told as the truth, because there is no the truth in the world. You have to use your critical thinking.
Thank you, Imran. Very good. Excellent. And it's very interesting to hear this analysis coming from you, having worked in the development sector, having worked with donors, having done Achievening, having studied here in the US, that you think that political economy is important, and two, that we should not leave everything to donors, and their dialogue or their discourse should not determine our analysis of ourselves, and that we should begin to think for ourselves independently, develop new ideas about our societies, argue and debate them, and that our children, our students, our thinkers must wake up to this new or a fresh way of looking at Pakistan, develop their own fresh analysis for us to move forward. So thank you very much. We shall come to the other subjects that you mentioned again later. As I said, we should try and do this as a part of our developing a discourse across the world on Pakistan. And I hope people like yourself can help me do that.
Thank you, Dr. Nadeem. It was really a pleasure.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai.
Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.